inflation is actually a positive in our microcosm of what we do. Just have to understand the factors. And I think the more you educate yourself and understand really what's going on, the more you start to be able to see the opportunities among the fear.
If you're interested in how highly successful investors overcome limitations and become unstoppable forces of success, you're in the right place. The Conscious Investor Podcast features weekly conversations with real estate investing experts and delivers a Monday mindset episode to help launch your week with intention. If you believe success is for everyone willing to think, then do, these conversations will be your weekly rocket fuel. Conscious investors, welcome, welcome, welcome back. Oh my gosh. Every time I open up an episode, you know that I always say, I have the best friends, I have the best guests, and I'm just absolutely blessed in that way. But last week, or maybe the week before, Kent and I recorded a podcast episode on his podcast. So we'll drop a link to that so you can go and listen to that, because it's going to be a very different conversation. And this week, we're recording on The Conscious Investor. In fact, I think we have, spoiler, we may do some one-off short little tidbits to splatter over social media. We're kind of joking around about it, but it might become reality and it might be very insightful as well as entertaining. But I have no doubt that you're going to appreciate a nice deep conversation here, as well as learning more about investing in a wild market. So without further ado, Kent, welcome. It's so nice to have you on The Conscious Investor.
Thanks, Julie. I'm so happy to be here. I've listened to your show for quite a while, and as I've gotten to get to know you, I'm just excited every time we talk. So I'm really, really grateful to be here today.
It's amazing. I'm like, wow, someone of your caliber listening to my show. No offense of fellow conscious investors, but you know.
Apparently there's high caliber people listening to your show. Look at this.
Wow. You know how it is? Have you ever had that experience where we don't always know who's listening to our show? Now, I'm blessed, right? Many of you have already left comments and you've over on YouTube, or you've left a review over on Apple or something like that. And if you haven't, please go leave something honest. Even if you don't like it, let me know. Let me know an honest evaluation. But unless somebody does that, how do you really know who's listening to your show?
Yeah, it is a strange thing about podcasts. Like, you really don't have much insight into your audience. You know, you can see kind of countries and places that they're at, but yeah, you don't really know. So it always kind of throws me off when I'll have, like, I was at my niece's graduation, high school graduation party, like a couple weeks ago, and somebody came up to me as like a friend of a friend or whatever. And they're like, oh, I just love your show. I listen to it all the time. And I'm like, really? Wow.
That's See, cool. Exactly.
Thank you.
Really?
Yeah,
it's, what?
Great.
I did not even know. I just thought you were a number somewhere.
Yeah. And now they're doing buying rentals and they're doing all this. And they're like, yeah, your show is great. And I was like, well, that's kind of why we do it. So it makes you feel good. But yeah, it just, you never know. You never know all the people you're impacting.
That's just it. Like every time, if you look at the downloads per episode or something, you're thinking like, wow, that was like a room full of that many people. And they all heard this message. I wonder what it's going to do in their lives. Like, how cool is that?
It's very cool. Having the podcast, I had zero expectations when I started. I thought it was going to go nowhere, honestly. And those are my own limiting beliefs.
I like your self-belief right there.
Yeah, no, it was 100% my own limiting belief of like, well, but honestly, it's added so much value to my life of just being, having interactions like that, but even like on a broader scale of people reaching out to me and sending messages like that, telling me how it's impacted them or that they learned about this technique. They're now doing it on one of their properties or something like that. That's so fulfilling. So cool. Yeah, it's cool.
It's like that missing link. You get to be part of the missing link for someone in their journey.
I think it's such a great medium to be able to just like, you know, anybody like me can just grab a mic and start talking about stuff. And
you don't even have to be a late night DJ listen. Or anything.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
It is pretty interesting how audiences grow and are cultivated and culture is cultivated and we all attract our tribes. And that's what's interesting about it is like the tribe, it just attracts like-minded people and everyone gets to grow.
And that's why I think so many different podcasts are important, because like one of my limiting beliefs when I was going to start one was there's a million out there. Like, what am I going to say that somebody else hasn't already said? And it's actually Joe Fairless that got me over that hump. And he said, look, he's like, it's not about what you're going to say. It's about how you're going to say it, because there's going to be people out there, like you said, your tribe, that are going to resonate with you that don't resonate with me, that maybe don't like my show. but they're going to like you and they're going to like how you say it. And so it's all about, that was what really made me be like, you know what? Yeah, like I should do this because I think I can speak to a certain group of people. I just have to find them.
And you are obviously very successful. So that's interesting. So I have a background writing and I always enunciate it because I also ride mountain bikes and stuff. So it's like, but a background in writing, and that was one of my limiting beliefs. And so it'd be like, why would somebody choose my article for that publication? And why would somebody, I have a manuscript. I actually believe in my manuscript. So it's like, that's fine. But initial, you have to work past that. So whatever creative outlet, like whatever medium you're using to disseminate your information, you still go through that same process of why would anyone, why me, everyone else is doing it. And I think that's one of the hurdles that every creative has to cross in order to have their content put out there.
Yeah, I think that the podcast was definitely a place of a lot of personal growth for me, as far as just, will anyone listen to me, right? And can I do this? And just technically learning a bunch of new skills. Because like for the first 6 months, I did it all on my own.
I didn't know you self-edit. Did I know that?
I would not recommend it to anyone because it's 10 to 20 to 50 times harder than you think it's going to be. And my podcast really, because of that, it was kind of choppy and sporadic and stuff at the beginning. And it wasn't until I really got a team in place that could really deliver good content on a regular basis, which is the most important thing, I think, consistency with the podcast. And so I don't recommend anybody going out and trying to edit their own unless you already know how to do that.
So I self-edited the first year and I made commitment to myself. So I was still a full-time teacher and doing the podcast and working on my business and all this stuff. It was a lot to be doing all at once. Mm. And yet there was some satisfaction in going back. And I think there is some merit to self-editing initially because it forces you to engage yourself in your content. Yeah. And you have to hear yourself. And so my kids, painful. Oh my gosh, they would know I'd be talking about, oh my gosh, that's my filler word. That's my filler word. I've got to stop saying it. It's a filler word. And so I was so acutely aware. I almost didn't want to talk anymore for a while because I could only hear those filler words, all these other things. And
yeah, but so that's the best way to get past them. I mean, when I was a management consultant and I was selling our services, I mean, that was some of the training that we would do is you would have to record yourself and then watch it. And the whole room would critique you. It was painful, but it was...
critique you.
Oh yeah. It'd be
a room. That's more painful right there.
Yeah. It'd be like a room of people, like 15 people all in a sales training and present to the room and record it. And then you would all watch the recording together and folks would critique you. It really stripped you raw, but it was also one of the best, I think, learning experiences because you have to do uncomfortable things like that to get better.
Okay. That's really interesting because that is that point of growth of that level of like learning to be that vulnerable in life and to receive the feedback, not as criticism, but as constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. These people are here. They're not here to tear me down. They're going to build me up. It's no different than having an editor send you your article that's bleeding red. And they're like,
that's right.
You get used to it. And now it's like the highest compliment. No, you're being honest with me and you're giving me honest feedback because you want me to succeed. But that's one of those growing curves in life. Do you think everybody gets to experience that? Or do you think our population is kind of scattered?
No, I think most people are in those situations. I don't think most people seek out feedback enough. And I think it's something you really have to seek out because I think most people, like this is a lesson I learned when I had a bunch of employees, right? And it was really resonated with me. It was like, look, because most people are really bad at giving feedback and most people are really bad at giving feedback, just don't give feedback. And so most employees never hear what they're doing wrong. And then they get an evaluation because you can sit behind your scorecard on evaluation and then pass it over and they get a bad score. And they're like, well, what the heck? I never heard about any of this. And it's not because you don't want to hurt their feelings. Like the reason you don't give feedback isn't because you don't want to hurt the other person's feelings. It's because it makes you uncomfortable and it's an uncomfortable thing to do. And so therefore you avoid it. We avoid it. Right. And I mean, what I learned and like the sign of a good manager is somebody that will deliver feedback consistently and timely, because that's the only way that people are going to get better. So I think that unless you really seek it out, a lot of people are just going to, they're going to tell you the good things, but they're going to avoid the bad things because that's a difficult conversation, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you have to seek out feedback. I think everybody should. I mean, even like with our investors, we just closed a couple of deals on Friday and we'll be sending a survey out to how did we do? What could we do better? Like there's some parts in the process that I know were more painful for investors than I would like them to be, just as far as like filling out paperwork. And so those are areas that I'm always trying to improve, but I'm sure there's other areas that I don't even know. The only way you know is by raising them up, and it's the only way you can fix them. So
yeah. What's interesting about that though, is that not everybody, even if you ask, not everybody will give you the honest feedback. So that's it's true. This weird.
Because it's more uncomfortable for them, right? It goes back to my point. It's like,
do they really want my honest feedback? And I ask people, if somebody asks me for feedback on something, I ask them point blank. I said, okay, listen, do you really want my feedback? Because I will give you my feedback and it's going to be 100% honest because I genuinely care. But if you can't handle that, then you need to not ask me for feedback.
Be careful what you ask for.
Because I do, because I'm actually that person. I've done like website evaluations and things like that for people. And it's honest feedback. And people are like, nobody's ever given us this type of feedback. This is so helpful. Thank you so much. Like we actually know where we can improve because they really wanted it. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, but most people don't know how to like.
So another lesson that I learned, which was really powerful, was kind of similarly, before we would give feedback, is ask the person if they're open to hearing it, because you're kind of bringing down that barrier. Well, one, if they say no, then there's no point telling them in the first place because they're not going to listen, right? Two, you're helping kind of bring down that defensive barrier though, because you're getting them like bought into it. So you start feedback by asking if they're open to receiving it. And then you tell them the context of why you're delivering it. And I'm doing it out of a place of love, right? Because I want you to improve. I want you to be better. I know you can be great. You've got a few things that we need to fine tune. But the only way you're going to be able to do that is by me helping you through these things, right? And so you got to give them that context. Then you can actually deliver the feedback. Then kind of blend in something nice in there too. It doesn't have to be all
doesn't have to be all red.
I don't necessarily believe in like the sandwich. You know, of like good, bad, it's good. But like, I think there's ways to also, without completely beating them down, like you got to make sure that you're, I don't know what's the right word. You know, you get
motivated.
You deliver the bad, keeping them motivated. Yeah.
You can't just crush somebody's soul.
That's what I'm going for.
Believe it or not, it is possible that I may have actually done that before, because I'm pretty blunt at times and very deliberate. And
you seem so nice and like cheery. And
I know. So I've learned like, because I just want, like, I say this, and then I don't know that my husband would agree with this, but I was like, just give me this straight up truth. Let me have it. Give me the information so that I can deal with it. It's very like pragmatic, right? So that's how I used to like really give that kind of feedback to others. And I've had to learn like, not everybody really likes that. It's not really healthy for other people.
You've got to have a certain amount of like mental fortitude, right? And I think if you're conditioned to be able to take that kind of feedback, that's awesome. But I don't think most people are. I think even people say that they are, they're not ready for.
They go into fetal position.
That raw.
Really true.
But the asking kind of for permission and then the setting context, I have found really helps open people up to that. And then, you got to tell them, you know, everybody's doing good and bad things, right? So give them some
that's of the just good. I mean, like really, it's never all one way. Or all the other way. There's a little bit of a, I like this. We're going to shift gears because I'm curious about closing deals in quote wild market that we're in and everything. And you're out golfing and checking your phone and to make sure deals are closing. I don't know what your par was for the day, and I don't golf. So maybe I used that thing correctly, but I hope it was still solid.
I'll be brutally honest. There were four holes. I think I just blacked out and I don't even know what happened because I was so angry about where we were with these deals. It was just like my golf game. It was not the best that I've played. Probably there's times where I try to do maybe too much. And maybe this was one of them, was having like a networking golfing event with two deals also closing that day. But at the end of the day, I say that, but we got it done. We got it all done and we got them closed. It was a bumpy ride, but we got there.
What were some of the snags? What is it? One, most people aren't closing deals right now. A lot of people are sitting on the sidelines. I'm not even going to participate in this market. I'm going to wait for everything. Like they're not structuring the whole buy side of things. So like you're already in this like elite group of not only are we going for deals, but we're closing deals and we are on that bucking Bronco and we're going to finish it.
Yeah. Let me tell you, I'll tell you about a couple. And before I do that, my public service announcement is like, by no means should you guys be sitting on the sidelines. I mean, if you want to invest in, like, look, there's market cycles, right? Stuff happens, but we are not in a bad time to invest in real estate. If you really understand what's going on at a macroeconomic level, which I'm happy to talk to for hours, it is a fantastic time to be investing in real estate, especially multifamily. If you understand the supply and demand imbalances that we have in this country, there's just a lack of housing. Interest rates are interest rates. By the way, the interest rate forward curves have come down a ton, even the past month. I mean, about 70 basis points from the peak that was expected. So like, we're already seeing signs that things are leveling out. So without going too far into that, just now is not the time to be sitting on the sidelines. This is not one of those moments. This is a moment to, this is now my personal opinion, to buy, because while everybody else is sitting on the sidelines, we're going to have a field day and we're going to get great deals. And I think the next 5 years are going to be an incredible run for real estate.
So, I love that. I'm with you on that. And I think there is the cycle and there is opportunity in every cycle. And I remember people crushing it in investing in the single family space where I was in 05, 06, 07. Yeah. And people still crushing it in 08, 09, 010. They pivoted, they changed their investment strategy to whatever the market cycle was. And like, they just cleaned house because everyone else was scared.
People that bought real estate in 09 and 10 the most money. I mean, you could throw a dart at a wall, pick a property, and you made a ton of money on it. So, and this is also like, I know I'm going too far off, but this is also just not... this is not a credit crisis. We're not in a credit crisis. And I think it's important for people to understand what a credit crisis means and why that hurt real estate the way it did. That's not where we are. We are in that interest rates have gone up some, but are still historically low compared to history. That's why they're historically low. It just feels weird because we've been in an abnormal environment the last 10 years where interest rates were zero. But this is like 5.5-6% interest rates. If you can't do deals with 5.5-6% interest rates, you should not be doing those deals. Like there's still plenty of room out there. So anyway, so back to closing deals.
No, okay.
I get on my soapbox.
No, I like the soapbox because I think I'm in agreement with, we already know that. You and I already know that. It's like, don't be on the sidelines. Don't let fear stop you. Like, take action. Know how to take the action.
Fear, it's fear and lack of knowledge. It's, I think, lack of just education on kind of the financial system and how it works and the difference between, like, people should not be comparing now to 08. It's apples and oranges. No. I hear it all the time. Then you look at the mainstream media. Well, it's just the news is just every disaster headline, right? It's gas prices and interest rates and all this. But again, if you go back to understanding commercial real estate is an inflation hedge because historically commercial real estate moves up with inflation. And so inflation is actually a positive in our microcosm of what we do. And so it's just, again, just have to understand the factors. And I think the more you educate yourself and understand really what's going on, the more you start to be able to see the opportunities among the fear.
Are you doing any specific education with your investors? I've heard a lot of people say their investors have pulled back, that they're having difficulty raising their, and I've seen it. I've seen different deals struggle to bring capital to the table. And so is that just their investor pool? Is that a lack of investor education? What thoughts?
In general, it's more difficult to raise capital right now. And that's not just me. That's talking with people who raise capital, like who raise venture capital. It's talking with PE firms. It's talking with across the board. Everyone I've talked to has said it's just harder because there's a lot of FUD out there. There's fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Right. And
oh my gosh, I love that.
And so if you, with that, I mean, the natural instinct, I think, is to just pull back and just say, no, we're not going to do anything. Right. But I think it's Warren Buffett, or, and I'll probably butcher the quote, but the essence of it is that there's the time to invest is when there's blood in the streets, for lack of a better word. Right.
No, like, that is what he said.
And there's by no means blood in the street right now, but there's fear. And we're seeing it. We're seeing less people at the table trying to bid on properties because people have just pulled back. We also have seen some softening in pricing. which is a function of interest rates rising. But again, that's why it's a good buying time, because interest rates are not going to stay high forever. If you even just Google SOFR forward curve, and you can see it goes up and then it comes down and it kind of goes around, right? And so there's a short-term peak, and then we start to normalize. And when things normalize, well, what happens? Well, everybody else is going to jump back in. And those things that you bought at a higher cap rate are now going to be back at a lower cap rate. And you're going to look like a hero. I mean, that's kind of how this all works. So I think that, yeah. So you asked me about investor education. Sorry. I'm hoping I'm doing that now. I've had a lot of one-on-one conversations with investors. So we just got done raising $10.5 million. Mm-hmm. And it was a difficult raise. One, just the sheer dollar amount, but two, just in the time that we're in, right? A lot of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So I had to keep some people in the deal 4 or 5 times where they're calling me saying, no, I don't think I want to do it. Had to talk them off the ledge, right? And kind of talk about these things that are going on and explain the broader fundamentals and the different dynamics and why, look, if you can just get past this focus on interest rates, then you can see all these other, there's a lot of levers that pull things, right? Interest rates are one, but like if you look at rent growth, I mean, rent growth is growing faster, way faster than interest rates. The rent growth we've seen on our properties is surpassing anything that higher interest rates have had any negative impact. You're also just seeing higher occupancies than we've seen, higher than any historic occupancies. And that's been kind of from COVID on. So there's a lot of good things. So I guess the investor education for me lately has been done more kind of around these individual deals and explaining all this. But yeah, I don't think there can be enough education out there just around what's happening, because I really do think it is a unique time and it's a really good time to be investing in real estate. And so I hope more people can get out and do that.
Yeah, I really think what you're saying, as I'm listening to you and like in total alignment with these other elements, right? The other levers that we have at the table, I feel like it's a little bit of Oz, like back there behind the curtain, pulling the levers. The media, and this is to their fault because it's a detriment to individuals, the media focuses only on one lever. And so I think average investor will say, if they're listening, ingesting even Wall Street Journal or the Times, or even those, they're going to be focusing, they're not going to be talking about the rent growth and occupancy rates. Okay, some of these might. It's not the headlines.
Yeah,
they're
no,
looking for their sensationalized interest rates. And so people are naturally just looking to this one lever as that's how I'm going to gauge all things. It's like, no, that's not.
My caveat in that, and the reason that I can kind of push interest rates off, is because the way that we underwrite to those forward curves. So like what that curve, that up and down roller coaster that's going to happen, like that's in our model. So like if the numbers look good to you, then that's already factored in. So as long as it does what we think it's going to do, 50 basis points again in August and all these other increases, like that's in there. So don't worry about it because it's already in there, right? And if you're comfortable with these returns, then it's fine. Plus we put an interest rate cap on kind of above that, right? So it does more than what we've already underwritten, then we're capped and we're protected. And so for me, it's easy to kind of say, don't worry about interest rates because it's already all baked in. Now, I do think that if people are looking, not everybody does that when they underwrite. And so I think that folks should be asking that question when they look at deals. So that's like my PSA is like, don't take what I'm saying as like interest rates aren't an issue, because interest rates have to be factored in and they have to be factored in correctly. Because if somebody's underwriting a deal right now and still saying their interest rate is going to be 4.5%, well, that's also a disservice because that's not the truth. That's not what's going to happen. So I think kind of understand both sides. They still have an impact, but also still a good time to invest. Just make sure you're asking the right questions of your sponsor to understand, you know, how have you factored in interest rates? Are you putting a rate cap in place? Different things like that.
I really appreciate this conversation so much, Kent. And one of the elements that I'm appreciating here is it really comes down to combating that fear with knowledge, with understanding, so that you can take forward momentum, like you can keep forward momentum, and you don't have to sit on the sidelines, because when you that knowledge and that understanding, you know how to run the play.
That's right. It is all about knowledge. It is. And there's a perceived risk to real estate because of just a lack of familiarity and a lack of understanding, right? We as humans, when we don't understand something or something is unfamiliar, our brain, crocodile brain, is like threat, right? And you're inundated with kind of this 401k mutual fund, yada, yada, constantly from your employer, from commercials, huge marketing budgets, right? And so you kind of hear that and you're comfortable. You may not even understand how the stock market really works, but my employer is telling me it's okay. And these guys are telling me it's okay and all that, right? We just don't, I just don't have as big of a marketing budget. It's similar, right? If I love that what we do is becoming more mainstream, whether it's through crowdfunding or any source, just the indoctrination of it, because I think with that familiarity, that perceived risk is lightened. I think more people will be open to it. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do, is just get more people in to real estate investing, because we all understand what an awesome impact it's had on our own lives, right? And so I love to see that. And there should be more education, because it is just a perceived risk. I remember when I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to leave this career and start a real estate firm. And my family was like, what? You're crazy. Real estate's super risky. All this. And it's like, well, it's not. It's not. And of course, there's a lot of ways to do it that are extremely risky, but like buying properties that are cash flowing and have been there for 30 or 40 years, cash flowing, which is what we do, and just fix them up, is not on the spectrum near the riskiest thing that you could do, right? So our properties just don't lose value. I mean, they don't drop 30% in 6 months like NASDAQ did, right? It just doesn't happen. It's again, perceived risk and just understanding and educating yourself.
Okay. So this is so true, because I was the bottom out of, I have three older brothers, and as the first one to have a rental and another, you know, it's like went down that path. And it's like, it's kind of funny when you're anomaly, it's like, I really don't want to do that whole bank on a 401k type thing. I want to do something different, because I didn't believe in it. I am like,
it doesn't work.
It's weird, because we're taught to invest in what we know and that we should be able to understand things in order to have a good investment, except when it comes to Wall Street. Like, I don't know.
Trust that.
I have a couple of friends that are day traders. You know, we all have our, like, you probably have more, but I mean, like, I know people and they're successful and that's their occupation. They love the stock market and that's great. Yeah. But ask every other person on the street, and most people can't tell you why it's doing what it's doing, or how it works, or when to buy or when to sell, or how to even know how to do anything. And it's like, but you've rented an apartment before, probably, or a house. More than likely, most people have themselves been in a rental. So they already know more about that type of investment.
It's easier to, I mean, God, in so many ways, it's easier to understand. There's so much more common sense related to what we do of like, okay, is it an area where you'd like to be? Is it a good area? Do they have good schools? Is it low crime? It's not, none of it's rocket science, right? It's like people want to live in places, other people want to live in the same places that you want to live in, right? For the same reasons that you would want to live there. There's good restaurants or amenities or schools or jobs, right? I mean, nothing that we do really is this rocket science. And I'm not one to say you should put all your eggs in one basket, because I definitely have a stock portfolio and I still have 401k from my old job and all these things. And I invest in other stuff as well. You should diversify. Like, the only free lunch is diversification. That's from some economist. I don't remember now, but that's a quote, because it's the only way where you can really increase your returns and lower your risk is by diversifying across multiple things. The thing that I like to challenge people on is I say, look, if you look at the richest people in the world and the largest endowments, Harvard, Yale, right? Like these really advanced investing institutions, their allocation on real estate is typically somewhere between like 20 to 40%. And so I said, it is a piece of their portfolio, right? And then you ask kind of the average Joe, well, what's your allocation of real estate? Most people say, well, nothing. I say, well, if it's working for the richest people and the most advanced investors in the world, don't you think it might work for you as well? And there's a reason that they're all invested in real estate. And so that's kind of my message is like, look, I'm not saying it should be your whole pie. Definitely should be a piece of your pie.
Yep. I agree. Actually, so our financial planner, I tip to the scales. Sometimes we'll do that. Just go to one extreme and then the other and then find the harmonic middle. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he's like, you really shouldn't put all your eggs in real estate. You really need to be diversified. And quite frankly, I actually should have put more into real estate back then, but just because it would have worked out better. But there is that truth. And I used to be actually like anti-stock market. There's a point to where you go like, there's a purpose for every investment out there.
Yeah, 100%. And again, you want to be invested in things that aren't correlated, right? Where a lot of people make mistakes is they think they're investing in things and they're diversifying, but it's all correlated, meaning it all moves up and down together, right? Like, so if you're investing in the stock market, right, you may think you're investing in, well, I'm investing in these different sectors, right? Well, look what just happened over the last 6 months. Like, everything's down, because at the end of the day, if there's blood in the streets, like we said, and people are scared, everybody's selling off, right?
Yeah.
One of the benefits about this, what we do, being more of an illiquid investment, is you can't sell because you're scared, which there's a lot of data that most people sell low and buy high because of emotion. I mean, it's behavioral economics. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of a forced savings plan built in to these 5-year hold periods that we do, because you can't get scared and just sell it at the bottom, right? So there's actually, like, I think, value there. I don't say that a lot. I don't usually tell investors that, but I kind of think about it that way. I'm like, actually, this is probably good for a lot of people's financial future, and that, because I mean, it's been proven over and over again that given their own devices, most people will sell at the bottom out of fear.
That's amazing. It's almost like having a CD or something like that. It's just locked in there, and mm-hmm. that's where it's at right now. I mean, and then when they go full cycle, I have something passive investment that's going full cycle this fall. Like, it will end up closing before the end of this year and everything. Yeah. And that's fantastic. It's just been doing its thing. I mean, there's nothing I could do about it, which is why I love passive investing. Like, this is fantastic. Like, I'm not doing any of the work. I'm getting the distributions, and I don't have to keep feeding it or think about it at all. I just have to let it do its thing. And a few years later, look at that. We have money babies. Love it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're getting cash flow throughout the process too, mm-hmm. right? Just something that's really hard to generate out of the stock market. I mean, there are definitely stocks that give dividends, but it's not meaningful typically. So, so be well diversified, right? And I think we're trying to get back around to these deals that I was working on.
But we are. That's what we do. We get right back. We get back there. So you had these wild deals. What was making them wild on the closing side of things?
So one of them was just a seller, unsophisticated seller, just very mom and pop style, to the point that the owner's girlfriend actually ran the property, 88 unit property. And it was managed by somebody who just wasn't a professional manager. And so we found out with this one, like, everything should have been smooth. Money was in way early. Like, we were set up. It was the seller that created their own issues on this one and created my headache. Jeez. There was a couple things. One, like, while we were under contract, they decided it would be a good idea to deed actually the northern 20 feet, like 20 by 150 feet of their property to the person to the north in exchange for an easement back. And apparently so that 20 strip included the northern entrance to our parking lot and actually like 3 feet of the building, which creates a lot of issues when you get a survey done. Yeah. And so we get the survey and like, kind of like, what the heck? And it turned out it was because of maybe some boundary dispute, just from multiple surveys, there was some gray area on kind of who owned that section. So they were doing it told to clarify the ownership, right? Well, the problem was they gave it to the other guy, and they give us an easement, but the easement didn't include a lot of things it should, like utility rights and a building was in there. And so technically the building didn't have a right to be there. So it just created a lot of issues related to our title. And so we had to unwind all these things and kind of understand what the heck is going on and how did this happen? And none of it was recorded yet. So that's why it didn't show up on any of the title work. So it didn't show up on any title work. What? It showed up on the survey, which took 4 weeks, 5 weeks, I think, to get back. So it came in way late in the game and we're like, what's going on? And then why isn't it recorded? This seems shady. There was a point where we're like, what are you doing? This seems shady. Then we figured out it was just kind of, they just didn't really know what they were doing. So lesson learned, don't deed a part of your property away, especially if you're under contract to sell that property. That doesn't work.
Yeah, I would just think that on one hand, kudos to that seller for maybe, I'm just an optimist. So I'm just going to say maybe they're trying to be above board and trying to keep a problem that was maybe persistent with the neighbor. Maybe they're trying to alleviate that as part of their gift to you.
Yeah. Definitely should have told us about it.
Yeah.
Because you get a survey back and there's like this piece that's crosshatched out and you're like, what is that? So that was one thing. And then the other one that was more immediate to closing was because we actually were hiring the leasing agent that was on site. She gave us some kind of backdoor info that the seller didn't share, that there was actually a lawsuit pending, one of the tenants and the seller, related to some things. And so this was like day before closing, and you don't want to buy a property and assume liability of a lawsuit. So we had to figure that whole situation out.
So what did you guys do with that?
Well, we were actually able to get the seller to sign an indemnity agreement that essentially indemnified us from any of the liability related to the lawsuit. So Now, we still have to fix, it's still our responsibility now as the owners to actually, because the whole lawsuit was arising from the fact that the seller hadn't fixed a bunch of stuff in this woman's apartment, allegedly, since right. going back to 2013. Now, like, why is she still there 9 years later? I don't know. But I mean, there's layers to peel, I'm sure, that if you really got into it, but
you should just give an easement and give half the building away.
Just give her the unit. Yeah. Just give her here. Unit. No. So anyway, we were able to do, just get them to sign an indemnity agreement, essentially saying like, we're not going to be held responsible for the outcomes of the lawsuit. We do still have to fix the unit now. I mean, it's our job as the owners to have a safe and mainly safe. We like it to be comfortable right. too, but it's definitely a safe place to live. And so we actually walked the unit today. Our property manager did, to actually like see what's going on and figure that out. And we're going to renovate all the units anyway. Like, we're doing a full, like, down to the studs renovation. So
you're going to start with hers? You'll need to move out for a while.
Yeah. We're kind of figuring all that out. But yeah, so that lawsuit came up and we had to get that figured out. And so, yeah, there were a number of things kind of seller related that came up that kind of threw wrenches and things at the end. But well, also just earlier in the process. So this is the first time I've ever retraded on a deal. And I had this thing where I never wanted to retrade, just because you make a deal and you want to stick to it. And I can tell you, even with rising interest rates, right? So many people used rising interest rates a way to retrade, right? To come back and say, no. And we did it, not because of interest rates. On our other deal, we didn't retrade. We just said, you know what? One, we had already
factored it in
a lot of that. And we already factored a lot of that in. And so we're like, yeah, we knew this was going to happen. Two, we're just like, this is a long-term game. You don't want to go and retrade with sellers or brokers, because you may buy something from that person again in the future, I may want to, and you're definitely going to want that broker to give you deals in the future. And so sometimes you just make sure you have enough cushion in deals that you can eat stuff like that and keep going. That's what we do. But anyway, we did retrade this one because the seller, I mean, just lied to us about, like, so it's one of those things where before you're under contract, they never let you walk all the units. So we walked six or eight of them, and they showed us the best six or eight units they had on the property. And they're like, yeah, they're all like this. They're all like this. And then when we walked all the units after we were under contract, I mean, there were just real issues, serious stuff that needed to be fixed. And so we went back and we had to ask for a credit. We're like, it was going to be so expensive. We had to increase our renovation budget by several hundred thousand dollars that the deal just
went
without it. So we went back and we negotiated with the seller and we were able to work through that. But that was, again, kind of a long process. And these are all kind of self-inflicted wounds by the seller. So my advice is, like, just be straightforward, because if I'm the one buying your property, I'm going to walk every unit. So
we're going to get every nook and cranny. I can't imagine not walking every unit, buying something.
I hope everybody does. Cool. Yeah. I hope everybody does. I've heard horror stories of people ripping out. What's that?
Yeah. That was my silence was.
Well, everybody should, because, like, I mean, I've even heard stories.
Everybody should.
Yeah. Of, like, maintenance guys ripping pipe out of one unit that's empty to replace in another unit. So you get there and there's, like, no plumbing, just all kinds of stuff. So yeah, definitely whatever you're buying, you should walk every unit, get in every crawl space, get in every attic, any nook or cranny that exists, make sure you've seen it.
Oh my gosh.
I used to be super frustrated because we would have a walk team and we would go do it. And then we'd go and, like, try to get feedback from the team. And they, like, well, I kind of think this isn't that. So now we take pictures. We did go to pictures. Now we just video every unit. Mm-hmm. So every unit we go in, we video the unit, and it makes it so much easier to go back and tie to, like, what actually needs to be done. So,
yeah, I hear people, particularly where I live. Remember, I'm in North Idaho in this little town that lots of preppers and things like that. Right. I'm like, there are a lot of people that don't like technology where I live. And anywhere, there are lots of people like that. I just have a higher concentration probably than the average area. I love technology for things like this. You go back not too long ago, and it would have been such a pain to video every single unit and to be able to just quickly upload it or share it or put it into this drive or this Dropbox or whatever. It's so simple now.
Yeah, it's so simple. There's no excuse not to do it. I mean, everybody's got a phone with a camera on these days, right? And then, because what I realized is, like, when you walk, like, three or four properties in a day, it's impossible to remember which one was where and what. And that's where the trouble would arise. And so.
And then you also have different perspectives. Like, man, if my husband and I are both looking at a property, and we were talking about yesterday or this morning or something about like the first house I ever bought, the toilet was literally sinking in the subfloor. And there's a property we were talking about in our area. And he's like, yeah, people say it's so bad and everything. I'm like, sounds like an opportunity. And, you know, just why not? And it's kind of interesting, like everyone's perspective is so different. So you walk a unit and somebody could say like, this place is trash. And the next person comes in, they're like, wow, that's pretty good. I mean, it's just so subjective.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. When we used to walk them, we had, you would fill the out checklist. Sheet, right? The checklist. And yeah, it depended on who was walking, right? You'd be like, yeah, this one's trashed, or no, this one's good.
And yeah, the carpet's got like another 20 years left in it, or the flooring, whatever it is, it's all fine. And the next person's like, this is so gross.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, what we're talking about is one of the most important pieces of what we do, because one of your biggest risk points is in your construction and in your renovation and your budgeting and how you do that. And like, to me, I always like to build up information from like the most granular and then like work my way up. So like, I literally want to know, okay, we have 100 units. We have 53 that need new carpet. We have 37 fridges that need to be replaced. And because otherwise you're just guessing and assuming, you know, if you're just saying, okay, we're going to replace 50% of the fridges, you know, maybe 70% of them need replaced, right? And so I think you have to do that level of diligence to really be confident that you've budgeted correctly and that you're not going to have to go back to investors and say, hey, this is worse than we thought. We need more money, which is like the capital call you never want to have to do.
You never want to have to do that.
I've been an investor in a couple of deals that have done capital calls, and you're always just like, this is why I'm so, I think, adamant about this, because my thought was always, well, am I throwing good money after bad here? Like, we couldn't get it right the first time and I need more money. It's like, I'm not sure that's something I really want to do. Things that you never want to be in a situation to have to do.
Gosh, that's, geez. Yes, definitely not. Oh my goodness. Kent, we can go on and talk forever because I'm like, it's just such good information. I'm like, favorite topic, favorite human. Like, this is great. It's like so much fun, but we're going to have to like, close it down. We're going to shut this down.
Unfortunately.
And so here's the deal. You amazing conscious investors who are listening right now, guess what? You can go over to Kent's podcast and you can start listening to his podcast if you're not already, because he has amazing conversations over there. So now you get like double dipping into two podcast worlds that are so much fun. So what you should do, right, is let us know what you gained from this. What was the most interesting point? I mean, we've talked about a little bit about some podcasting experiences and leaving feedback and constructive criticism and supporting people. And we've talked about this market and really identifying fear and educating ourselves so that we can proceed forward and not lose that momentum. And wow, what am I going to ask my sponsor about when they walked that property and dealing with the hiccups that naturally come? I think every deal has its natural hiccups. So like, there is never quote smooth closing.
I still haven't been through one. I'm waiting for that day. Every time we sit down and do like our postmortem and we're like, how do we make this easier next time? There's always just new challenges. You got to be able to just navigate them.
That's what's so fun about real estate though. I mean, it's that creative. It's the Wild West. You don't know what's going to come your way. We've covered a whole lot of territory in this conversation. So let us know, leave a comment and let us know what your preference was, like what served you best out of all of the delicious content here. And then make sure you go head over to Kent's podcast, like do some binging over there and then leave some rating, review, all of that over on his podcast, because that's just a great, great thing to do for everybody. Now, Kent, aside from your amazing podcast, which will be in the show notes, where else do you want people to go?
Yeah. So you can go to KentRedder.com is kind of my home base. We've got, so obviously the podcast, and we've got a blog, a weekly blog we do, which is focused on really a lot of how to be a good investor. We've got a lot of new content for folks, like terminology and FAQs. So just stuff, if you're looking at your first deal, things that help you kind of at least be able to talk the talk a little bit, or just general common questions that come up. So you can just, again, start to educate yourself, right? And then exciting enough, we're actually launching Hudson Investing's site, my business site, and that will be up probably by the time this airs. It'll be up in a couple of weeks. And so that'll really give people a sense of our track record and what we're out to do as a company, as the company's grown beyond just me to now a whole host of people. It's not just me anymore. And so I think that'll give people a really good place to really understand what we're trying to do and what we've accomplished so far.
That's awesome. Absolutely fantastic. Kent, I appreciate you. I value the time that you've bestowed upon the Conscious Investor community today. And we got to do it again. It's always Definitely. A great conversation.
Yeah, always so. A good time. Thank you, Julie. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. Amazing Conscious Investors. Remember, adventure belongs on the trail, not in your investing, not in your financial investing, and not in your personal life investing, right? So if you need support in either of those areas financially, then make sure you reach out. Let's have a call and talk about how we can support you in your investment goals. If you need support on that personal development side, remember, I'm a high performance coach. I can support you in that way so that you can activate and live that life to your full potential. So don't leave anything on the sidelines. Let's play hard. Let's play all out and keep adventure on the trail. Until next time, live big and love even bigger.
What's the big deal about investing in apartments? Why is it better than investing in a slew of single family homes? I've compiled a lot of information on why investing in a multifamily, also known as apartments, will help you reach your investment goals. Head over to 3keysinvestments.com and download the Why Invest in Multifamily guide today.